AstronomyCast, episode 578, Venus Updates. Welcome to Astronomy. You know, we can't just say Venus Updates. That's boring. Okay, let me do this again. Ready?
Yes.
AstronomyCast, episode 578, Life on Venus? ? Welcome to AstronomyCast, our weekly facts-based journey through the cosmos, where we help you understand not only what we know, but how we know what we know. I'm Fraser Cain, publisher of Universe Today. With me, as always, is Dr. Pamela Gay, a senior scientist for the Planetary Science Institute and the director of CosmoQuest. Hey, Pamela, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. It has been the weirdest of weeks. I don't know about you, but every time we get one of these NASA media advisory or Royal Astronomical Society media advisory that is completely vague, someone asks, so it's not aliens, is it? And this time when someone asked that, I found myself just sitting there going,
yeah,
it's been a weird week.
it's funny. So I don't know if people know about this. So the policy for Universe Today, and if any of my writers are listening, just a reminder, is that we don't look at embargoed stories.
Right.
So if you send Universe Today an embargoed story, we will delete it. We won't break your embargo, but we won't look at your embargoed story. We are not interested until after the embargo has been lifted, and the news is publicly available to everybody. And you know, the reason why is I find that it allows people to decide who's a journalist and who isn't a journalist. It's sort of a way to control the no's and the no-nots. And for the longest time, a lot of really respectable, who I thought science journalists, were being held out of the embargoed news information. It's not so bad these days. And then the other thing is to sort of artificially inflate the newsworthiness of a piece of news. And so you and a couple of the writers on my team were like, we've got a really important embargoed news story that's come across my desk. Can we work on this?
Well, I wasn't sent the embargoed information either.
Yeah.
But one journalism outlet that I'm not going to slander, I accidentally pressed the publish instead of the schedule button in WordPress.
Yeah, we saw that.
And so the article was out there. And of course, this led to people going through and putting the pieces together.
Yeah. Apparently, you could even figure it out by looking at Wikipedia and seeing which articles in the astronomy and science section have been modified recently.
Oh, gee.
Yeah.
That I hadn't noticed.
Yeah,
that's
pretty clever
awesome.
To figure that out. But yeah, so I was just as unaware as everybody come Monday morning when the announcement was made. And it was totally worth it. What a great announcement to hear. It was. Maybe. Possibly. Aliens, finally, which we'll get into during the show.
Yes. Yes, we will.
All right. So have you heard the news? Of course you have. Evidence of phosphine on Venus, which could be a biosignature of life on our evil twin planet. There have been a lot of surprising stories about Venus. So let's get you all caught up. All right, Pamela, what's the news this week?
Okay, so this week's news, and we're going to have so many articles that we need to explain to give context to this news. This week's news is the biosignature molecule phosphine, which is one phosphorus atom and three hydrogen atoms, has been found in the atmosphere of Venus in amounts that can only be explained in ways that we know. The universe tends to be creative, but using physics and chemistry and biology that we know, the only way to get this much phosphine into an atmosphere is to stick microbes in that atmosphere.
There was a great article, I think it was the BBC did this. They said you can have pollution from industry or penguin poops.
Yeah, pick one.
Yeah, pick one. And so we know there are definitely not factories or penguins on the surface of Venus. Therefore, super weird to see this chemical in the atmosphere of Venus.
And this particular atmospheric gas is produced by a variety of anaerobic bacteria. This is single-celled life forms that don't need any oxygen, and there's not exactly a lot of free oxygen at Venus either. So what we're seeing is consistent with a kind of life that could exist there, and intriguingly, just in the past couple of months, a number of popular level articles and one professional article detailing how you can have the cycle of life in the Venusian atmosphere.
Yeah, that's pretty, it's pretty funny. There was a bunch of these papers on phosphine, on how life in the Venusian atmosphere could be generating phosphine like a month ago.
Yeah, yeah.
So I actually had one of these, I had this paper by Sarah Seeger and team about how bacterial life could survive in the cloud tops of Venus and what the mechanism might be. We can get into this later on in the episode. I was like, oh, that's such a cool idea. I'm totally going to do a video about that. And so I put it on my list of videos. Little did I realize Sarah Seeger, you know, playing three-dimensional chess here, had this all queued up and ready to go for the moment we got the announcement of phosphine on Venus. Everyone was like, where could it be coming from? And she can just go, wrote the paper. Very smart.
And I asked her about that during an interview I did on the Daily Space, and she said that they hadn't initially planned to write that paper, but they'd been working with a journalism student who was doing such a good job that they decided to just move ahead with everything. So it is the fluke of having the right intern in the right place to motivate things forward that led to that earlier paper coming out.
Okay, so we've got the discovery of this incredibly weird element, phosphine, or molecule, sorry, in the atmosphere of Venus. We don't know of a natural process. So how, this is to the how do we know what we know part, how did they discover this molecule in the atmosphere of Venus?
You pointed a couple of telescopes. So literally what happened here is people have been suggesting since, well, looking for biosignatures was a thing, that along with methane, phosphine was a particularly good biosignature. And unlike methane, which is super easy to make geochemically, phosphine doesn't seem to have the same geochemical way of being produced, at least not at Venus. So Jane Graves was looking in the Venusian atmosphere, following up on a number of other research threads. So just in the past year, we've had, coming out of the European Planetary Sciences Conference last September, the idea that up until as recently as 750 million years ago, Venus may have had water oceans and a habitable environment before something catastrophic took place. We've had papers showing that if you use modern numerical models to analyze the Magellan data, looking at the surface features on Venus, it looks like there's still active volcanism
right
there. And then when you couple all of this with the known problem that there are these UV-absorbing splotches in Venus's atmosphere that have no known explanation, except there's bacteria on Earth that have the same characteristics.
Right.
It sort of starts to become a, you know, we really need to be looking for life here kind of situation. And what I have to admit I didn't know until I was prepping to talk about this week was the idea that Venus might have life in its atmosphere goes all the way back to the late 60s and hinges on those dark UV absorbers to a certain degree.
Right, right. So, I mean, I think one of the things that I really loved about this announcement was how careful and how skeptical the researchers themselves were, which was that they did really, really meticulous observations to determine the presence of the phosphine in the atmosphere of Venus, and then spent an enormous amount of time looking at every possible natural source that could be generating it, from volcanoes to lightning to meteorite strikes in the atmosphere and even to the point where they said, okay, like, yeah, volcanoes could produce phosphine, but you would need 200 times as much volcanism on Venus as we have here on Earth. And although there might be evidence of recent volcanism on Venus, not 200 times as much as Earth.
Right, right. And so this is where they had a really cool interdisciplinary group working on this. So you had Clara Sosa Silber, who's the phosphine expert, who was looking at what are all the chemical attributes. You had Sarah Seeger, who is very much a theoretician looking at how do you understand things in the context of the atmosphere. They brought in people to look at geochemical processes, to look at photochemical processes. And across all of these different things, they also had to consider, okay, so we had a low signal-to-noise observation with the James Maxwell Clark telescope down in Hawaii. So let's apply for telescope time to get a better set of observations from the Atacama Large Millimeter Array. And they got those observations. They went through the trouble of trying to figure out, are there overlapping molecular lines that we need to worry about at this wavelength? They did their homework to make sure this wasn't a different molecule stepping all over their phosphine observation. They checked every box and...
Yeah. And so they absolutely found phosphine.
Yes.
And they very rigorously ruled out every possible natural source of phosphine.
That we know of.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that's the problem, is as new paper after new paper keeps finding, the universe likes to be far more creative than our theorists. So there always has to be that nagging concern of, well, what if there's physics that I hadn't thought of going on here?
Yeah. Yeah. And right now, it's probably almost certain that they will discover physics that they didn't understand before, that there will be some geologic process, some weird combination of sunlight hitting phosphorus-rich acids that combine in different ways. Like we do know that phosphine, because it has those hydrogen atoms, combines very rapidly with oxygen. It oxidizes as quickly as it can. And so you can see phosphine in Saturn and Jupiter because they're oxygen-poor environments. Any oxygen,
and hydrogen-rich.
And
they
hydrogen,
have free
yeah.
hydrogen available to do the bonding.
Right. While Earth and Venus are oxygen rich. We've got plenty of carbon, you know, in Venus, you've got all that carbon dioxide, carbon dioxide.
and with Venus, so the thing is that it doesn't have that free hydrogen that we see in the gas giants. And so in this reducing environment, it's really hard to figure out where did those hydrogens come from. And so this is where, like, the person with the PhD really wants to say, I'm sure we're going to find physics that we just don't know about right now.
Yeah, I just said that too.
But here's the thing, and this is one of the things that I'm really struggling with on this discovery, is NASA has invested a great deal of funding since the mid-90s into understanding what molecules are biomarkers. Mm-hmm. What molecules, when we see them in extrasolar planets, mean this planet probably has life. And we found one of those molecules in a world that I have to wonder, if it was an exoplanet, would we be sitting here going, no? Or would we be saying a biomarker was found?
Yes.
And because it's Venus, which, let's face it, most of us have been like, that's the one place not to go looking for life. Does this force us to be over-skeptical? It's this really weird internal conflict of, wait, but we identified biosignatures for a reason and we found one, but now we're saying it's probably not life.
Yeah. What's wonderful about this is that we do have an opportunity now to double check. So if we didn't see phosphine in the atmosphere of Venus, then it would sit on that it would be the gold standard of biosignatures that have been worked out so far, as you talked about. You know, up until this point, people thought, oh, it's oxygen, it's ozone, it's water vapor, it's methane. Yeah, it's methane. It's all these things. And now it turns out we've found natural processes that can supply each one of these. But this one molecule, phosphine, has held out, defying any natural cause that isn't life or industry in a oxygen-rich world. And suddenly it's been discovered on a world that's very close that we can double-check. Because now you can send a spacecraft, you can send a balloon, you can go and examine it more closely and try to figure out what the source of this is. But if James Webb detected phosphine around GLIZA 582 or whatever,
yeah,
there's no double checking. You can't go and send a spacecraft to just give the atmosphere a sniff. And so this is a wonderful opportunity.
So here's the story we have right now from various observations. We have from the Magellan data of the surface, an understanding from Coroni. These are the geologic signatures in the shape of the ground saying this is where there's a hot plume of magnum beneath the surface. We have evidence from Magellan's radar data of the surface that there are order of 30 volcanoes that appear to have been geologically recently active. We have brand new climate models thanks to advances in computing. And the advances in the computing also got us the volcano results. Thanks to advances in computing, we have new atmospheric models that consider, well, okay, so we're now understanding that during the Great Heavy Bombardment, watery things crashed into the inner worlds. Mars had oceans, Earth still has oceans, Venus should have had oceans. So let's run the climate models, assuming the water is there. And it appears that from these models as recently as 750 million years ago, you had Earth-ish, Earth-hot environment capable of sustaining life and having oceans. 750 million years ago here on Earth, we had the beginning of colonies of single-celled organisms. So things like sponges that are made of single-celled organisms that act as a group, we had those. And so you can imagine on the same time scale, life having the ability to come into existence on Venus or panspermia to have done whatever right. It felt like doing between these three planets.
Yeah, and I guess that's the other question is, I mean, if we do find life on Venus or Mars or Europa or Enceladus, are we related?
Yeah.
And when?
And so we have those questions. And then we have today the active and changing pattern of UV dark absorbers in the atmosphere of Venus that have characteristics that are mirrored by actual bacteria that can temporarily rise up into the Earth's atmosphere for hours or days, but no longer than that.
Yeah.
But the conditions in Venus's atmosphere, where it has essentially standing water in the atmosphere in the form of moisture droplets, means that what is transitory on Earth can be permanent on Venus.
So let's talk about that paper that Sarah Seeger and team published about what possible mechanism, how could life be surviving on Venus?
So the first thing to remember is don't go to the surface of Venus unless you're trying to melt a spacecraft, because that's how you melt a spacecraft.
Right. Yeah.
The surface is hundreds and hundreds of degrees. Whatever unit you pick, it's death. But if instead you go up in the cloud layer between roughly 50 kilometers up and 60 kilometers up, you're looking at an atmosphere that has Earth-like temperatures.
And Earth-like pressures.
And one atmosphere pressure. Now, as soon as you get down as low as like 30 kilometers, 33, 35 kilometers, it's death again. But you have that window. And so the idea is that Venus, like every atmosphere, has currents within the atmosphere, and it has what are called Hadley cells, which are circulation regions in the atmosphere, where in the equatorial areas you have hot air rising, and then it comes down cooler towards the poles. And so the idea is that there's this haze layer down in the 30s kilometers up, and air from this desiccated, dried out death haze layer is able to rise up. Now, what if there were spores, desiccated life forms in that haze layer? They can then act as seeds to moisture droplets. We have the same thing happens here on Earth. It is around dust particles in the atmosphere that rain droplets form, or this is how we know you can seed clouds and it works. So you have these spores that act as the seeds of moisture droplets that are rising up through the atmosphere. And as they rise up, they can get bigger and bigger, taking this desiccated life form, re-moisturizing it, allowing it to thrive, to multiply. And as the water droplet, or moisture droplet rather, gets bigger and bigger and bigger, it'll eventually get too big as it's circling through the atmosphere. And as it falls back down, that water droplet, moisture droplet, will fragment, and eventually the life will be driven to desiccate out again. And we see life forms desiccate out here on Earth. This is something tardigrades do. It's why you can shoot them up into space and they come back, and they come back to life.
Yeah.
We could have tardigrade-like life cycles.
Yeah.
But a different extremophile, or heck, maybe even tardigrades.
Now, you keep saying water, and then you keep editing yourself to say liquid. Let's talk about that liquid, because it's, I mean, there's some water. I think there's like 15% water, but there's 85% not water, sulfuric acid.
Right. And so, yes, the Venus atmosphere is largely death by acid. Mm-hmm. Largely death by acid. But largely is not the same thing as completely death by acid. Here on Earth, we have extremophiles that are quite happy to deal in just about any environment you put them, whether it be radiation, acidity, heat. We can find the life to live through it, and a lot of it's at Yellowstone.
The one interesting thing is they've actually looked at the level of acidity in this sulfuric acid, and it's super bad. Like it's worse than, it is more acidic than any environment that life has been able to survive in. But the key is that you've got these droplets of water that are dissolved into the acid. And so the thought is that in fact you could have the life living in the water that's in the acid. As long as it stays in the water droplet parts inside the acid, then it's able to survive going through this cycle. And so the liquid builds and builds and builds as these droplets rise up in the atmosphere and then rain back down. And hopefully the microbe has completed its entire life cycle before it turns into rain and falls back down, before its spores end up back down at that 33-kilometer haze altitude and the whole cycle continues. But theoretically, they did the math, and this could go for hundreds of millions, billions of years, just over and over and over again.
And this is where you can start to speculate wildly. I'm admitting this is science-based wild speculation.
My favorite kind.
That when whatever catastrophic event occurred that caused the runaway greenhouse event on Venus, whenever that occurred, if it was a world like our own that had a vast diversity of microbes capable of surviving in pretty much any niche in the environment you can imagine, there's the chance that some of them could have figured out how to rise up in the clouds or been carried up and just happen to survive and find a way to evolve over the generations to be what was needed. Life finds a way.
So suddenly everyone is asking, what spacecraft are at Venus that can help confirm this discovery?
None.
Yeah. There's the Japanese Akatsuki spacecraft is there, and it can see, you know, wind and atmosphere. Yes.
And that is all well and good, but not entirely useful.
Yeah. Bepi Colombo from the European Space Agency is on its way to Mercury and is going to be able to do a flyby of Venus and be able to do some detections. But we're going to need something custom built for this.
And ideally, what we want to do is take things on balloons or gliders and have a way to go down to these various altitudes within the atmosphere and ideally carry an instrumentation package that allows them to grab up samples of the atmosphere and then look at them under a microscope they took with them.
Right. Or sample, return them home.
See, that starts to become far too large of a mission at that point. We want answers faster than that.
Sure,
do that in a generation or so, but life is short. Build the Discovery class mission now.
Yeah, there's a couple of missions that are that have been in the works. There's one from NASA. There's one from the which was just dropped into the atmosphere. There's some suggestions of balloon-based missions which will hover in the atmosphere of Venus and even go up and down in altitude to follow some of these thermals. The Indian Space Agency has a mission in the works. The Russians have one.
And Rocket Lab.
Yeah. Yeah, we saw Rocket Lab actually has a Venus mission that they had been planning that they dusted off. Again, coincidence?
So the Rocket Lab one is the one that amuses me the most. It'll probably be the fastest to complete. The entire spacecraft will be about 15 kilograms. They'll have 3 kilograms for instrumentation, not a lot of power. But let's see how creative we can get in figuring out how to do this. We built a little tiny itty-bitty helicopter for Mars. All we need is a balloon for Venus.
Yeah, yeah. But there are some other plans as well, things like the Havoc mission, which would send blimps, even human operated blimps, to the cloud tops of Venus, and then they would use a blimp-based rocket to return back to Earth. Because it's still, like, you're still going to have about 90% the force of gravity once you're in the... It's easy to get to Venus, easy to enter the atmosphere as long as you stay off the ground, but it is tricky to get home again.
I feel the need to point out that, like Mars, Venus doesn't really have that whole magnetic field thing going for it. Mm-hmm. And so if you don't like your astronauts, sure, send them there before we have figured out how to take care of radiation.
Well, it does have that atmosphere, though. It helps.
It helps, but you're not going to be too deep in the atmosphere.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, you're going to be up pretty high. So.
And there's the whole getting there part, although it's faster to get there. And the cool thing about Venus, unlike Mars, is because we're outside Venus's orbit, there's multiple landing approaches per year.
Yeah, we can go there pretty much any time we want. Unlike Mars, we have to go every 2 years. So a lot more opportunity to go there and a lot more opportunity to come back with that sweet sample return mission that should be in the works right now. All right, so now you're all caught up, everybody, on the discovery on Venus. Obviously, we will keep you filled in every new discovery that gets made as this goes. It's one of the most exciting discoveries in the field of planetary science and astrobiology in years and could act as the cornerstone of our future searches for life across the universe. So hopefully this is really exciting.
It really is. And if you want to hear interviews with David Grinspoon, who's one of the researchers who's been studying the potential for life, or with Sarah Seeger, who's one of the authors of these research papers, check them out over on dailyspace.org. This is the short form daily podcast we put out from CosmoQuest.
Fantastic. All right. Well, thanks, Pamela. Do you have some names for us this week?
I do. As always, our show is brought to you by you. You are the reason we're able to keep doing what we do year after year after year. So right now, I would like to thank Jordan Young, Burry Gowen, Berko Roland, Ramji Anmatu, Jeffrey David Macarsini, Andrew Palestra, David Trug, Brian Cagle, the giant nothing, Dan Littman, Robert Plasma, Laura Kettleson, William Les Howard, Paul Jarman, Joss Cunningham, Corey Davalo, and Emily Patterson. Thank you all so much for being here and being part of the numerous people that support our show.
Thank you, everybody, and we'll see you all next week.
Thank you.
Astronomy Cast is a joint product of Universe Today and the Planetary Science Institute. Astronomy Cast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution License. So love it, share it, and remix it. But please credit it to our hosts, Fraser Cain and Dr. Pamela Gay. You can get more information on today's show topic on our website, astronomycast.com. This episode was brought to you thanks to our generous patrons on Patreon. If you want to help keep this show going, please consider joining our community at patreon.com/astronomycast. Not only do you help us pay our producers a fair wage, you will also get special access to content right in your inbox and invites to online events. We are so grateful to all of you who have joined our Patreon community already. Anyways, keep looking up. This has been Astronomy Cast.